Just because they're out on the street and homeless and don't have a job doesn't mean they're not human. They should have human rights where they have a place to live and have something to eat every day, you know?
The biggest thing is when you start losing yourself, you feel like you have no worth. You have nothing to give back. You get deeper into your addictions, and the more guilt you got because you're not around your family, or and it's getting worse.
Affordable housing is so important. It's the basis to everything. Having stability. And if you have stability, you're able to cope a lot better with, you know, COVID, mental health, addiction. Without affordable housing, without that stability, the rest of that's going to affect your life so much more.
I've never been this well. I swear to goodness, in my entire life.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Winter is Coming. This is a podcast where we are asking how we go from housing crisis to housing justice. And what you just heard at the start of today's episode was the audio from Safe, which is a documentary film from John Butler, a documentary that features tenants of the Indwell affordable housing communities and their stories of being targeted by housing injustice, of living close to the streets, and the hope that comes with supportive, permanent, affordable housing. And if you want to learn more about how you can support the documentary, how you can view that documentary, check out the details in the captions to this podcast, or Google Safe Documentary or search YouTube for Safe Documentary. This is a show where we feature a series of conversations on the housing crisis, and specifically looking at the housing crisis in the north of Turtle Island, in what we now call Canada. And if we zoom into that, our context here, where we're recording from, is the traditional territories for me of the Haudenosaunee, the Anishinaabe, and Neutral peoples, just outside of what we now call Kitchener-Waterloo in the province of Southern Ontario. And we are in our second season here, and we are talking all about how we go from housing crisis to housing justice. And on this show, when we say housing justice, we're talking about the comprehensive approach that really, truly helps us to figure out how do we enshrine housing as a human right, something that we say, we talk a big game about, but we know when we go down our streets in many cities and rural areas that we know we're not living out. So housing justice is not just about one thing. It's about the comprehensive approach that, yes, puts roofs over people's heads, yes, makes things more affordable so people can not have to choose between rent and groceries. Yes, it involves emergency shelters. It also involves supportive housing, affordable housing. So it's looking at this comprehensive approach about how we get from housing crisis to housing justice. And the housing crisis is not a one-size-fits-all approach. And so we need to have lots of voices, lots of perspectives. And that's what the show does. We wanted to take a second this week to let you know who's behind this podcast. Two groups that have come together for the Winter is Coming podcast are Trinity United Church, which is a church in what we now call Kitchener-Waterloo in the province of Ontario, Canada. And they are a church dedicated to advancing housing justice, advancing the resources and infrastructure of supportive housing and affordable housing in their community, but really all over the north of Turtle Island in what we now call Canada. And as well, the Hub Community Network, which is a network of youth and young adults seeded from the United Church of Canada that lives to empower young people to connect with the liberating love of Christ and build a more justice-rooted and inclusive world. So that's who's behind this podcast. Outside of this project, we also run a companion project called the Supportive Housing Advocacy Group. And that group meets two Wednesdays a month online to talk about how we can support each other in advancing affordable housing in our various projects and our activism work in our community, as well as putting out housing advocacy calls to action. So if you want more information on that, you can check the caption below. We have John Neufeld with us today, who is the executive director director of House of Friendship, which has been serving what we now call Kitchener-Waterloo, traditional territory of the Haudenosaunee, the Anishinaabe, the Neutral Peoples. It's been serving in this community that I live, that many of our listeners are coming from, for decades. And so we're delighted to have John on as somebody who has done a ton of work in his role as in House of Friendship and elsewhere to make a world that moves us closer to housing justice. So John, thanks for being on today. Thanks for making the time. You're a busy guy leading House of Friendship. The work that that you do and the work that so many of the folks that we've talked to on the show do is, aside from some of the federal leaders, we've talked to Mike Morris and some other people who work at the legislative level, but so much of the work when we talk about justice, when we talk about housing, and when we talk at the core about belonging, about creating belonging, like you're talking about, is it's local, it's in our community, it's relational, it's with people you know or people who are in your neighborhood. What does that local aspect look like right now in 2024 in terms of where we live and now in what we now call Kitchener-Waterloo? What are we seeing played out that is working locally on that community, that grassroots level? What are we seeing that maybe is not working or gaps in our local communities? Because I think that applies not just to places like Kitchener-Waterloo. I think we can apply that to multiple communities. What are you seeing?
So what's going on? You know what? You're right. Nothing unique to Waterloo region. This is across our great nation. I would say it's across North America. We've got some very similar things going on, and it's fascinating to watch how different communities are responding in different ways. You know, I'll share my views on how I think Waterloo region is responding. But let me take just a step back, Adam. I've been thinking a lot about taxi drivers and hoteliers the past year. And I didn't empathize with them as much initially, but my empathy has grown significantly for them because I'm starting to realize I'm in the same place they were in a few years ago. And, you know, imagine that taxi driver, life was going along well, providing for their family, working hard, or the hotelier, you know, working hard in the hospitality industry. And then all of a sudden, you know, Airbnb shows up, Uber shows up, and you just know your industry has been forever changed. You know, you cannot go back to the way it was. That's gone. But you actually don't know what the future looks like and what you should do. Yeah. And you're scrambling because, like, your livelihood is threatening, and it's such a difficult place to be in. And I keep thinking that's the place that those of us who are serving in the housing sector, addiction sector, that's the place we're in right now. And that's not unique to us, only our sector. There's lots of sectors going through massive transformations. The church is going through this, right? Faith communities are saying, We know the future needs to look different, but we don't know what it's like. We can pine for the old days all we want, but they're done. And so what do you do in this middle space where you actually don't know what you're working towards, but you know you got to do something? And so part of it, to be honest with me, with you, Adam, is we need to take a pause and give ourselves some grace and say, this is the period we're in. Nobody has the answer. Some will tell you they have the answer, and some will tell you if we do X, this will solve all of our housing stuff, or it's just because of this, or it's because the government isn't doing this. Listen, we got ourselves in a housing situation that we're in. It took decades to get here, and there's multiple factors that contributed to the place we're in, and it's going to take us a long time to get our way out. So one, let's just accept that no one has the answer. It's not as simple as one little thing. And let's be okay with the discomfort of that. Let's not try to find silver bullets, easy solutions. Mm-hmm. We need to get our hands dirty. And so what does someone in a leadership role do in a, you know, charitable organization like House of Friendship? Again, we can't do everything. But I'll give you an example of something we've done, or how it's, you know, how has the transition in our community impacted us. And, you know, I'll go back to 2015, because it actually ties in with the church that Trinity shares space with, St. Matthew's. In 2015 was the first time that it was kind of the old expression of the canary in the coal mine. Something's different, something's wrong, winter's coming, and our shelters are over capacity. We have nowhere to go. And literally, we did a 911 call to St. Matthew's, and we said, there's no space anywhere in this community. And literally, within a few weeks, St. Matthew's became a shelter, an overflow winter shelter. And that was the first time we had to do something like that in our community. And now it's been a pattern ever since. And we've been scrambling ever since to try to figure things out. And that's when that was the first signs of something different is going on here. Like this feels different than my first 7 years at House Friendship. There's something with the people we're serving, like what's going on. And, you know, and some of your other guests, and you've had much smarter guests than me on this podcast who've already, you know, talked about some of these issues, but one of the biggest ones and is synthetic drugs. And if I think about, you know, why do I talk about being a taxi driver and hotelier? Because what Uber and Airbnb did in those industries, synthetic drugs have done to us, to those of us who are trying to provide housing and addiction support. They are so radically different, you know, from the meth to the fentanyl, and the impact they have on people's brains, the bodies. So the drugs are way more accessible, they're way more addictive. And their way they do such permanent long-term damage. And so all of a sudden, who we're serving is far more challenging, is lots difficult. You know, Adam, I don't remember hearing the word overdose in my first 7 years at House of Friendship.
Really? Wow.
I don't, you know, there was a time at House of Friendship we constantly had empty beds in our shelter, and we were worried about like how do we fill these beds, you know. And if you remember, in our, you know, and Trinity was part of this, a big part of this, we had the Out of the Cold movement for
Yes.
many years in this community.
Yeah, I remember that as a kid. That was how I got to know. I didn't go to Trinity as a kid, but I knew them and other churches as running this Out of the Cold program. And talking about youth group, I remember it's what sticks out to me. I don't remember every youth group I went to, but I do remember when we had a guest speaker from the Out of the Cold program come and talk to our youth group.
So why did the Out of the Cold eventually shutter, right? It's because the volunteers and the kind of stuff that they were all of a sudden needing to deal with and behaviors and that so radically changed. And, you know, for me, all of a sudden, staff safety was a massive concern in a way that it wasn't before. And we had like these incredible, committed, dedicated staff who were dealing with overdose, with death in ways that, you know, I sure never dealt with as a, you know, a 20-year-old working at Covenant House in Toronto. And so it's just really all these things kind of came crashing together. And what do you do? What do you do? And then there was a time period there was nowhere for where people were to go. People were feeling unsafe. And the lights started going on, like this whole model of just providing someone a bed and a meal. It's broken. It doesn't work. And I often talk about, you know, if one of us had a loved one who was diagnosed with cancer and you brought them to the cancer center and the doctor said, you know, we'll give you a bed, we'll give you a meal, but we won't give you any chemo or radiation. I mean, we would be outraged, but that really is how we were addressing homelessness in our community. We thought, we could just put a roof over someone's head, give them a meal, you know, a listening ear and care, like that somehow will cure them. And we weren't actually addressing the underlying issues of homelessness. And so that kind of put us on a path. And you know, we visited a model in Ottawa through Shepherds of Good Hope. And we saw there that they actually had integrated healthcare right into their shelter. And they brought basically the hospital into the shelter. And we were so inspired by that. And so we started talking about this model of shelter care and that we thought was what we needed to do in the community so that While individuals were in shelter, we weren't just warehousing them or housing them. We were actually helping them move on their mental health, their addiction, their physical health, so that when we could finally get housing for them, that they were more ready for it, and could stably housed. In the past, you could move someone from a shelter to housing, and generally it could work. But I think as synthetic drugs kind of entered Canada, North America, that became more and more challenging. And we saw what was happening is people would get housed and then they'd get kicked out. Housed, they get kicked out. Housed, they get kicked out. And so we've also had to rethink what housing first looks like in 2024. Simply housing someone from an encampment or simply housing someone from the street into their own apartment unit isn't enough. Without addressing their health, without addressing, issues of belonging and community, you have to look at all these things holistically. And so I'm really grateful. There's some silver lining in the pandemic, as hard as it was. And it's a well-known story in this community, but for your listeners, I'll share is that, at the beginning of the pandemic, right in March 2020, we were panicked. We have this little shelter just down the street from your church, We had 51 gentlemen staying in 12 bedrooms. We had them all rammed into just a few rooms. And we thought we were going to create a massive outbreak in the community. And we've forgotten March 2020, none of us knew anything. This is pre-vaccines, masks,
Yeah,
understanding
you didn't
about
know
all
where you
this. And
could
so,
go and where you could breathe. Yeah.
and we called public health and they said, you got to isolate these two individuals that are, showing symptoms. And we said, we have nowhere to isolate. And, in one of these moments that I still can't believe, and, for someone of people of faith, they will say, well, that definitely wasn't just a coincidence. I was on the call with lots of other leaders in the community saying, like, we're going to cause an outbreak. I'm not sure what to do. And at the same time, an email comes through from the Radisson Hotel. How can we help? And I called them immediately and I said, I need to move my shelter into your hotel tomorrow or as soon as possible. And I've never forgotten the response, Adam, on the other end of the phone. The rooms will be ready for you tomorrow morning. And we
Wow.
literally, the next day, put everyone in a bus and moved into the Radisson Hotel. And that was the beginning of, I would say, shelter care, where everyone had their own room. But what was different is we quickly in the basement set up an impromptu medical clinic in the basement of the Radisson Hotel. And, we had doctors, nurses, addiction professionals just kind of helping out. And so with a lot of dignity, people in the building go downstairs and get their mental health, addiction, physical needs addressed. And then 6 months later, we started looking at our data and we said, oh, it's been a 50% drop in overdose, a significant drop in violence and staff unsafety. We have a significant drop in the use of ambulance and police, like somewhere in the neighborhood to 60 to 70%. And so we knew that there's something here with this model. And so we kept discussing it. And long story short, there was a lot of pain, blood, and pain in between, but we were able to be given the opportunity to purchase a hotel in Waterloo, which we did in 2022. We took a year to renovate it because we know that spaces matter, how they are designed, and that they need to be dignified environments. They need to have appropriate supports in place from, ability for people to have their addiction addressed through safe use spaces, medical clinics so that people's physical health can be addressed, counseling rooms for mental health. And so that happened. So that opened February 2023. So next month is our 1 year anniversary. And
Yeah.
I think we've already housed over 20 people out of that program. People's health is improving. They're more ready for housing. And, 30% of the individuals in the shelter care program are receiving active addiction treatment. And that may not sound like a lot to some people, but I would say before this model, that it was at about 0 to 1%. Because when you're living in a shelter where you're just getting a bed and a meal, and you're just trying to survive, and you're trying to figure out what's next, and you don't have the space and the safety and your health issues being addressed, you're not going to think about, oh yeah, I should probably get some counseling, or you don't have that space to think about it. But once you get that counseling treatment, all of a sudden there's a pathway to get reconnected to your family, to your children. Housing starts becoming a bit of a greater reality. That's sort of our contribution. And I'm not saying shelter care is the answer, or is the silver bullet. And you're asking me, what is it would look like here in Waterloo Region? And one of the things I'm so incredibly proud of this community is that we're just trying stuff. And this is what I'm talking about. We're in this in-between space. We don't know what the future looks like, but we know we can't go back to the past. So we got to try stuff. And I love that this community is really embracing it, and different organizations are trying different things. And from that we can learn, and what's working, what's the piece that we can learn from this program, or what's the piece from this approach. And I think in 10 years from now, when we look back, and different community, because every community in North America, every major urban center right now is struggling with overdoses, with encampments, with rising homelessness, with rising drug addiction. I don't think there's an urban center that's spared from that in North America. And if you do your research and do some reading by people who've done excellent research on this, they'll even tell you there's places that didn't even know what homelessness was just a few years ago. But because of the synthetic drug era and how strong of a hold that's taken across North America, now have, their downtowns are compromised, and there's lots of challenges. And so we've got to do things differently. But when we look back in 10 years, the communities that were compassionate, were innovative, that responded, that love their neighbor are going to be further ahead. And the communities that somehow believe that they're gonna, I don't know, simply police their way out of this, or it's just about not being compassionate or not trying different things, those are the communities that are gonna fall further behind economically and have other ramifications. So there's a, as I shared with you at the beginning, I also look at things through a business lens. And for me, economics needs to make sense. This isn't just about compassion. And I think addressing issues of homelessness and poverty is not just a justice issue. It's also, there's an economic argument for it.
Absolutely.
If you want to have thriving downtowns, but you don't have infrastructure to support your most vulnerable there, you're not going to have safe downtowns. You're not going to have thriving businesses. And so we have to work together to support each other in this.
And I like what you shared there to kind of hit on that note of the myth of monocausality, the ability sometimes for us to look back and go, this crisis was caused by one thing, or there was one, one source, that silver bullet that you talk about, and how that connects to what you're saying here of there's also not one solution, and that's come up multiple times. That's why we love to spotlight different voices from different organizations, and not just different organizations structurally, but different approaches. I mean, we've had folks from the Working Center, from Indwell, and from now from you, from House of Friendship, which are have their own unique philosophies, have their own unique approaches. And what is clear is that it is not a one size fits all solution here. And so to have that comprehensive approach, and I agree, we look at folks in the community who are trying things, folks who have done grassroots movements like A Better Tent City, folks who are working to make housing advocacy heard. One of the things that we can do in between elections is continue to work with local leaders and make voices heard and continue to propose how, you know, a faith community can be a solution. Lots of churches who have worked with an organization like Indwell are able to say, how can we use our space? How can we use maybe our space that isn't being used in the same way, you know, our sanctuary that isn't needed in the same way as it once was? How can we try things to respond to this? When you look out at what is working even beyond a house of friendship, what do you see as beacons of hope? Maybe what do you see in terms of people organizing together or individuals making a difference or individual projects? What are things that give you hope that we are able to actually start moving in a positive direction, knowing that, as you said, it is going to take a long time?
Well, you already mentioned it. Like, let's just look here in our own community. And I think the ball got really rolling with, you know, St. Mark's and St. Paul's churches that said, hey, we've got this asset. We're called to do something. We know there's help needed. And I think the way faith communities are just really even focusing in on this issue in a new way and reimagining, you know, I love going to St. Paul's Church there in partnership with Beyond Housing and what they did there, right? I mean, here's
we just talked to Dan Dreger from Beyond Housing before this episode airs. People will have heard from Dan.
Right. And like I said to you, you've interviewed far smarter people than me already. So I'm not going to tell you anything new. But, you know, and years ago when some of us were chatting with the faith communities about this, I kept saying, we just need someone to go first. We just need some. And then all of a sudden, you know, and then it was St. Mark's and St. Peter's. And I know there's a number of other churches now that are looking at it. But I think this is going to unleash a lot, because I think people are starting to see the potential that this has. And it revitalizes our purpose and our mission. And this is what young people and young adults want to see if they're going to be part of a faith community is, you know, is this just somewhere we gather on a Sunday morning, or, you know, how is this actually going to make a difference in the community? And I think this type of discussion about housing really invigorates people and is part of the solution. And so, you know, when people ask, what can I do, or what can I do to make change? It's simple. Get involved, go beyond the headlines, and get your hands dirty. And be prepared to be both delighted and disheartened and sit in that tension.
Yeah, when you say go beyond the headlines, the thing I often talk about with our young adults and my other leaders is it's more than a share on social media. It's great to communicate. It's great to make awareness, and absolutely we can use social media to enhance our knowledge of issues. But it's so easy to stop. It's so easy to stop there. And as you said earlier, we live in a time where it's so easy to just critique, to just deconstruct what's wrong. And the algorithms of social media and the tech companies, that's what they will push more. We know that that gets more attention. In the same way, you know, bad news is good news for popular media for many decades. But the ability to go beyond the headline, beyond sharing something on Instagram, and to actually want to be part of building something, not simply critiquing, not simply deconstructing. I think it's a challenge for what our culture is so conditioned to, and yet it's vital, and it's vitally possible for us to do that.
Absolutely.
I want to ask you about what 2024 in particular looks like. You know, the show is called Winter is Coming, and we're aware that in some ways we recognize that that's this constant thing, that we're always in winter or another winter is coming, and that's why there's always work to be done. And yet also we know every winter is different. So when you look at 2024, I want to get your honest take, knowing that we want to look at engender hope. But as you said, this is also not something that's going to change overnight. When you look at housing in let's just keep it to our local community here in Kitchener-Waterloo as an example, what do you see as the outlook? What's ahead in 2024? Is it is it a Is it a time that gives you hope? Is it a time where as you said, we're in a time of figuring out, of experimentation. But for this year, what do you feel and what do you see on the horizon in terms of housing?
Well, we're embarking on the largest housing project we've ever done in our history, and planning to build a significant number of housing units on the former shelter in downtown Kitchener. So, you know, we're hopeful because we know the housing that we're going to build isn't, it's only going to make a dent in some of it. But again, that's the piece we can contribute, and that's the piece we can control. We've been given some gifts, we have some assets, we have some property. And so that's what we're going to focus on. Adam, winter is particularly harsh. I just wish we wouldn't just think about this in winter. You know, since 2015, I've been going to council and saying, this isn't a climate issue. This isn't because it's winter. We have this challenge all year round. Homelessness has increased in this community, and it really started that, I would say, back in 2015. You know, I think we need to have less temporary places.
Yeah, a great reminder. Yeah.
We need to have more permanent things. If I look at, you know, shelter care and what that has done for both the people we're serving there and for the people that we're serving there. The other thing, you know, there's a group of people that never gets talked about in this discussion that is very hard for me and disheartening for me. And it's the volunteers, and it's the team members from all of our organizations that do this frontline direct service day in and day out, the toll that it is taking on them in kind of particular, and I would say in particular this era and time of the synthetic drug era and the kinds of things they have to see and deal with. And, you know, no one focuses on them and thinks about them. And I have to be honest, that's where my heart breaks a little bit, because imagine the toll that it takes to have watching people kind of in such immense pain, being tortured by their addiction, being, you know, by their mental health. And so, I mean, one of the things is when we have, you know, when we don't have permanent places, when we don't know how we're going to do things, it adds a whole nother layer of unsafety. It adds a whole layer of stress to who I think are truly the heroes. And, you know, I walk into our programs and I see what people have to work with and deal with. And yet they come with so much compassion and hope and love. They inspire me each and every day. And I just want to honor the team members across all of these organizations that go in and do this day in and day out, the volunteers that are willing to spend time with the people we're serving. This is not for the faint of heart. This yeah. is not easy work. There's no, this isn't a shiny Instagram post kind of stuff. This is hard, gritty, heart-wrenching, challenging. And there's individuals that do that day in and day out. And I think we have a responsibility to those people as well. It's not just for the people we're serving, but it's the people that are doing the serving. You know, what do they need? And so that's what we're trying to, I think we need to do that simultaneously, is how do we do both? So I think we need to stay hopeful. I think we can't just keep focused on just what's broken. I think there's a lot of things that are going right that we need to do more of in this community. So that's yeah. sort of my approach.
Well, when you talk about the way we can uplift, honor, encourage, care for our frontline workers, our staff, our volunteers. I mean, as we said, a lot of the folks listening here are from church land. And what a church have more experience with than hospitality, than fellowship. And so we often talk about the things that churches, church communities, and churchgoers can do. And you've picked up on a new note that we haven't talked about here on the show, which is the ability for even churches to create gatherings or events or spaces to honor, uplift, thank, give a delicious meal to frontline workers to honor their doing so that they can have bread for the journey is to me a beautiful possible takeaway from that as another thing that, and again, not just that certainly churches can do, but that any community group, that any grassroots just group of people in a neighborhood could do, is find out who in your neighborhood is on the front lines, who in your sphere are serving in housing, and how can we support them, because it takes a village. So I think that's a beautiful way to kind of land here. And I want to thank you for just the organic places this conversation went from, understanding that critical nature of faith background, of youth ministry, and the ability to engender leadership development skills in folks, how that led you on a path, and how that is something that, again, we need to continue to invest in. And as so many churches face an uncertain future, I can say for a fact that many, many youth have been left behind in that. And the ability for us to reinvest in youth, reinvest in the development of leadership in youth is key. And I think that's a beautiful spirit for us to take into our next conversation. So John, thank you so much for being with us today. Just as we close, how can people, I know you were really humble and saying, you know, House of Friendship is very known in the community, but for folks who maybe don't know, how can they follow the work that you're doing? How can they follow and maybe get connected in some way with the work that House of Friendship is doing? If that's their call to action that they feel the Spirit calling them to, how can they get connected?
Just through the website. That's simple enough.
Awesome. So that's houseoffriendship.org, and we'll put a link to that in the description of this. So John, thanks for this conversation. I'd love to have you back and chat more, because there's so many places that we could continue to dive into, even just from the branches of this conversation. So I hope we can have you back again in the future.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Adam.
Thanks, John. Well, that is it for today. So thank you again to John Neufeld and to the great people at House of Friendship. For Winter is Coming, we will be back our next episode next week. You can tune in on any major podcast platform, and we will see you next time.